Kind Heavenly Father, we are indeed grateful that you have provided us with this wonderful atmosphere in which to praise your name. We would ask for the presence of your Spirit to touch our hearts and our minds that we might better understand your will for us and that we might be more effective witnesses in every aspect of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, you know, we very often wonder what we can do in our lives to be witnesses for God. And you hear people coming up with all kinds of convoluted plans and schemes for how they can witness. But I'd like you to think today as I tell you a little bit about my own story, about some of the things that perhaps have happened in your own lives. Now, one of the differences between people who develop a great deal of faith and go on to achieve significant things and those who do not is that those in the former category will frequently take time out to reflect upon their lives, to think about where they've been, where they are, and where they're going. That's one of the reasons that God gave us so much mental capacity, so that we could spend time doing that kind of reflecting. And then when we challenge our minds, then we make them more available, I think, to the biddings of the Holy Spirit. You know, very often we read in the Bible about individuals like Joseph, who was sold into slavery, maintained a strong faith in God, was true to his convictions, and ended up as the prime minister of the most powerful country in the world at that time. And we think about Daniel and the three Hebrew boys who came into Babylon as captives and ended up in high governmental positions. Again, not without difficulty, but maintaining their convictions and also developing their intellectual abilities to their fullest extent so that they became valuable individuals, such that the rulers recognized them as valuable individuals. And that provided a tremendous witness for God, because the rulers... What is that? Interesting. But the rulers became very interested in the thing that was behind those young fellows because of what they knew and what they were able to do. An important concept to keep in mind again as I talk. And the last thing I want you to keep in mind as I talk is don't apply everything I say to somebody else. Think about your own life. You know, we always have a tendency when we hear something, we say, oh yeah, yeah, that's the way such and so is. We never seem to want to look in the mirror and ask ourselves the question, am I like that? Do I do things like that? So just a little critical introspection. Now, life for me was not always easy. Certainly, I can remember as a youngster, at the time that my parents were divorced, feeling like the bottom had fallen out of the world. I was 8 years old at that time. And you know, to an eight-year-old, there's not a whole lot of things that are super important. Eating, sleeping, television, Nintendo these days, and having a family structure that is solid and dependable. And perhaps that latter thing is the most important, really, if you sit down and think about it. And all of a sudden, that was no longer there in my case. And that was very traumatic. And I wondered, you know, was any of this my fault? The fact that my parents were breaking up. And I was praying and asking God somehow to help them to be able to get back together. But it didn't happen. So there I was at age 8. My brother was 10. And there was my mother with only a third grade education and the task of trying to raise 2 young sons all by herself. No money, no education, no resources, no place to turn. So she had to ask God for wisdom, and he gave it to her. And one of the things that she felt that would be important is to move to a place where there was some support. So it turned out we moved to Boston to live with her older sister and husband in one of the tenements in Boston. Now, I know there are not a lot of tenements out in this part of Pennsylvania, but I think many people who live here in the eastern seaboard, particularly in the northeast, are familiar with tenements. These are large, multi-family dwellings, broken glass, boarded up windows and doors, winos, sirens, gangs, drugs, murder, you name it. It's there in these big inner city tenements. But perhaps more impressive to me than all of those things were the roaches, because they were extremely aggressive there. And, you know, they act like you should be paying rent to them. And they would be not only in your cereal box, but they would crawl on the table, too, while you were eating. But more impressive than the roaches were the rats. They had something there called water rats. Now, these things were beasts. They were very large. In fact, first time I saw one, I thought it was a dog. And they could move garbage cans by themselves. And we were always horrified because there were rumors circulating about how a few of these things would get together and drag some kid off and eat him. So we would like to stay out of the environment where they might be able to gang up on you. But while we were enjoying that environment, my mother was out working very hard, you know, doing the kinds of things that you can do with a third grade education, washing people's floors and taking care of their children, washing their dishes, what have you, working 2, sometimes 3 jobs at a time, attempting as much as possible to stay off of the public welfare rolls, and hoping beyond hope that perhaps one day she could become independent of her older sister and brother-in-law and be able to move back to Detroit, which we were eventually able to do after a couple of years. Again, we moved to a dilapidated section of Detroit. It wasn't that big of an improvement, but at least we were independent at that point. And I was in the 5th grade. And I wasn't known as an intellectual giant when I was in the 5th grade. In fact, you might say I had no competition for last spot in my class. Frequently when I talk to grade school students, I ask the question, who's the dumbest kid in the class? And interesting enough, several people raised their hands. And I have no doubt that they must be pretty dumb to do that. But in my 5th grade class, there would have been no question. Everybody would have turned around and pointed to me. The kids thought I was a dummy, and the teachers thought I was a dummy, and I thought I was a dummy. Really, the only person who didn't think I was stupid was my mother. And she would always say, Benjamin, you're much too smart to be bringing home grades like this. But you must realize I had typical American boy mindset. You know, the best thing to do was to go to school and goof off all day. go home and play until dark outside, and then go inside and watch TV until bedtime. I mean, what could be finer than that? And my grades reflected that attitude. I was always the first one to sit down when there was a spelling bee. Never knew the definitions of any words, never knew any state capitals, never knew any states, never knew anything. And this is what was expected of me. And I remember one day we had taken this math quiz, had about 30 questions on it. And you would pass the quiz to the person behind you, and they would correct it, give it back to you. Teacher would call your name, and you would report your score. Well, this one had about 30 questions on it. And when the teacher called my name, I said none. But she thought I said nine. And she got so excited. And she said, Benjamin, you got nine, right? Oh, this is wonderful. This just makes my day. Life is worthwhile. Oh, I'm so happy. And she just ranted and raved for about 5 minutes. And the girl behind me just couldn't take it anymore. And she stood up and she said, he said none. Well, of course, she sat down exceedingly embarrassed. And all the youngsters were just roaring in laughter. They were beside themselves. And I'll tell you, if I could have just disappeared in thin air, never to be heard from again, I would very happily have done so at that moment. But unfortunately, I couldn't do that. So I had to act like these things didn't bother me. And when I was the butt of all the jokes about being a dummy, I had to act like it didn't bother me. And I used to try to belittle academics and study. You know, very much like young people, many young people do today, who don't do very well, and they like to try to belittle the academic achievements of others because they don't feel capable of achieving themselves and they're afraid to try. Young people, the next time you see one of your peers trying to belittle your academic achievements, just remember, it's probably because they're afraid to try themselves and they want everybody to be like them, acting stupid. So just don't listen to them. But that's the way I was. I remember about midterm in fifth grade, when I took my report card home, my mother was horrified to see these terrible grades. And my brother wasn't doing particularly well either. She was trying to figure out what could she possibly do to help us to understand the importance of an education. You know, a lot of times in this country, young people take education for granted. They don't realize what it can do for them. But I'll tell you, all you have to do is go and live in another country for a little while. And then you can realize the tremendous opportunities that exist here in America. You look at a group like the Vietnamese, a lot of the Vietnamese boat people who came here, you know, 15, 16 years ago. And I'll tell you, when I was on the admissions committee at Johns Hopkins for the medical school, consistently, the best applicants that we had were Vietnamese refugees. And I'll tell you, the reason for that is because these individuals came over here and they saw just incredible educational opportunities staring them in the face. And all they had to do is take advantage of it, and they could do virtually anything they wanted to do. And see, a lot of times people from other countries realize that, while the people sitting right here in this country don't. And then they complain that other people are taking opportunities away from them. Nobody's taking any opportunities away. It's right there and it's available for everybody. All you have to do is take advantage of it. Well, at any rate, we were not taking advantage of it. She didn't know what to do, so she prayed. Again, asking God for wisdom. And you know, it's an interesting thing. You don't have to have a lot of education to ask God for wisdom. Now, I would much rather have somebody on my team with wisdom than somebody with a PhD and know wisdom. You know, there's a big difference between knowledge and wisdom. You can acquire knowledge, but wisdom comes from God. And wisdom is what gives you the ability to use that knowledge appropriately. Well, at any rate, he gave her the wisdom. At least in her opinion. My brother and I didn't think it was that wise, because it was to turn off the TV set. So we could only watch 2 or 3 pre-selected TV programs during the week. And with all of that spare time, we were to read books from the Detroit Public Library. 2 books each week. And submit to her written book reports. And we didn't realize she couldn't read them. So we had to go ahead and submit written book reports. Now you can imagine how enthusiastic we were about that. But you know, she never dictated what we had to read. And you know, if I would go to the library and start going through the books, some of them looked kind of interesting. There were a lot of books that had pictures in them. Interesting, bright color pictures of animals and plants. And I started reading, initially, mostly the books that had a lot of pictures. But pretty soon, you know, I was looking at the captions. I wanted to know what it was talking about. Started reading more and more of the words. And pretty soon, I really didn't care that much about the pictures. I was much more interested in the words that were there. And I remember getting very, very interested in rocks. We lived near some railroad tracks. And near the railroad tracks, of course, there are a lot of crushed rocks. So I would go out with my little box and I would collect all kinds of rocks and then come back home and pull out one of these geology books and compare until I could find the rock that matched. And it wasn't long before I could tell you just about the name of any rock, where it came from, how it was formed. Still in the 5th grade, but this thing really caught my imagination. And nobody in the 5th grade knew about this project, and as far as they were all concerned, I was still the dummy. And one day the science teacher walked in with this big black shiny rock, and he said, "Does anybody know what this is?" Well, of course, I never answered any questions, so I waited for one of the smart kids to raise their hand. None of them did. So I waited for one of the dumb kids to raise their hand. And none of them did. And I said, "Well, this is my big chance." So up went my hand, and everybody turned around and they looked, and they said, "Carson? How could he possibly know the answer?" So they took in a big breath. They were ready to laugh hysterically because they knew I was going to say something stupid. And the teacher called on me, and I said, "Mr. Jake, that's obsidian." There was silence because it sounded good. No one knew whether it was right or wrong. And the tension mounted. And finally the teacher said, "That's right. That is obsidian." And I said, "Obsidian is formed after a volcanic eruption. The lava flows down and it hits the water and there's a supercooling process and the elements coalesce and the surface glosses over and the air is forced down." And as I went on explaining these geological phenomena, everybody was looking at me. Their mouths were hanging open. They could not believe all of this information spewing forth from the mouth of the dummy. And as I looked around in their eyes, I saw something I'd never seen before. Instead of the usual look of disgust and disdain, there was a look of admiration and respect. And you know, I was perhaps the most surprised person in that classroom, because it dawned on me at that moment that maybe I wasn't so stupid after all. And I said, you know, Carson, the reason you knew those answers is because you were reading those books. And I said, you know, there's no reason that you have to be the butt of all the jokes about being a dummy anymore. He said, there's no reason that you can't also know more than everybody else about social studies and science and history and geography. All you have to do is read those books. And from that point on, I could not get my hands on enough books. I read everything in sight. And within the space of a year and a half, I went from no competition for last spot in the class to no competition for first spot in the class. Much to the consternation of many of those students who used to tease me and call me dummy. And I remember one day going up to the fellow who used to be the smartest guy in the class. And I said, Steve, how'd you do on that exam? He was a rather boastful fellow, rather obnoxious. And he said, I got a 91. And I said, well, that's too bad. I got 100. And I said, next time if you need help, let me know. Perhaps a little bit obnoxious, but it sure did feel good, I must say. And by the time I was in the seventh grade, all the students were coming to me, asking me how to solve math problems, and I would say, sit at my feet, youngster, while I instruct you in higher mathematics. I was having a good time at that point. Perhaps too good a time. I was maybe a little bit on the obnoxious side myself, trying to sort of overcompensate for the time when everybody used to think I was a dummy. I had to demonstrate how smart I was all the time. And I remember that used to get on some people's nerves a little bit. Fortunately, I did get over that eventually. But I was on the right track academically at that point. But you know, I still had a very substantial problem. See, I had this horrible, horrible temper. I was one of those individuals who felt they had a lot of rights. You know, the more rights you think you have, the more likely you are to get angry. Just think about the times when you're driving your car and somebody gets in your lane. You know, the one you own, the one you paid for, and they get in your lane. And how angry you get. Sometimes you want to call them names and you wish you had a bazooka mounted on the front of your car. Well, you see, that's the way I was. You know, I thought I had all these rights. And I remember one time a fella hit me with a pebble. And I picked up a large rock and threw it at his face, smashed his glasses and almost put his eye out. Another fellow was trying to close my locker before I was ready for it to be closed. And I grabbed the lock and put it on my knuckles like a brass knuckle and hit him in the forehead. Put a 3-inch gash in his forehead. And another time my mother was trying to get me to wear something I didn't want to wear. And I picked up a hammer and tried to hit her in the head with it. You know, other than that kind of thing, I was pretty good. But this was really a pathological temper that I had. And I had tried to get it under control, and it just didn't seem to work very well. One day, I was 14, and another youngster angered me. And I happened to have a large camping knife. And I took it, and I lunged for his belly, tried to stab him in the abdomen. And fortunately, under his clothing, he had on a very large metal belt buckle. And the knife blade struck it and broke. Of course, he fled in terror, but he was not as horrified as I was, as I realized that I was there trying to take the life of a fellow human being over a minor incident. And I knew that I was 100% completely and totally out of control. And had he not had that belt buckle on, he would have been killed or seriously injured, and I would have been on my way to jail or reform school. instead of realizing my dream of becoming a physician. And I went home and locked myself in a bathroom, started contemplating that situation. And, you know, a few months ago I was speaking to the inmates at San Quentin Prison outside of San Francisco about making choices in life. And it really struck me while I was sitting there looking up at all of those faces, and they all had to listen. I had a captive audience. And I was looking out at those faces, and it made me think that I could have been in a place like that had it not been for the grace of God. You know, a lot of times we look down on other people. We turn up our noses at other people, or we think we're superior. But you know, we need to realize that had it not been for the working of God in our lives, we could be in that same situation. So easily, things can turn around just like that. Somebody can lose their job, and their family can be out on the street in a matter of weeks. So the next time you see somebody in less fortunate circumstances, don't be so quick to pass judgment. Maybe it might be a good thing to ask yourself, what could you do to help that individual, to help themselves? Well, at any rate, things were not all that wonderful with that temper, and I was there in that bathroom contemplating that situation. And I said, God, it's my understanding that you can change people. And I said, I need a change. And I stayed in that bathroom for 3 hours praying and contemplating. And I started reading from the book of Proverbs. And it had a lot of things to say about people who can't control their temper. For instance, in Proverbs 16:32, it says, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. Yeah, and I started thinking about that. I said, do you realize that God considers a person who can control their anger of more significance than a conquering hero in a battle? I said, that's pretty substantial. And I thought more and more about that. And I kept reading. And it seems like every chapter had something in it. I turn over to chapter 19, verse 19. It said, a man of great wrath shall suffer punishment. For if thou deliver him, yet thou must do it again. And that's the way it seemed for me. Always getting in strife. Always getting into some kind of trouble or another. Then I read in verse 28, chapter 25, verse 28, he that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls, which was exactly how I felt, like Satan could come in and take control anytime he wanted to, could just get me with that temper, get somebody to make me angry. And you know, after reading and contemplating and praying for 3 hours, I walked out of that bathroom, and that temper was gone. And I've never had another problem with it to this day. You know, people sometimes say, but you must be seething inside. You must be so angry, and you just learn how to hide it. Well, I'll tell you, if that were the case, I would probably have ulcers and hypertension and all kinds of psychosomatic disorders right now. It just doesn't happen. Because when God cures a problem, he cures it completely. He doesn't just put a little powder over it, but he actually gets rid of the problem. So it simply is not a factor anymore. And I sometimes have a great deal of pleasure watching people trying to get me angry, because I know they're not going to succeed, and that in the long run they're going to become frustrated. And it just, as long as you recognize that you can call upon God for strength and that He's right next to you, there very seldom will be anything to get angry about. And I recognized after that episode that God was powerful and that God was real and that He was somebody you could call upon at any moment just like that, and He would be at your side. That He was not going to force Himself upon you, but that He was available for you. And I decided to adopt Him not only as my heavenly Father, but also as my earthly Father. And it began to dawn upon me that God is a nice guy. He really is. You know, these concepts that some people carry around about God peering down and seeing every little bad thing you do and writing it down so it can be brought up on the day of judgment, that's not the way God is. He's only interested in one thing, and that's saving your soul. He doesn't care about the bad things that have happened in the past. But what He cares about is that maturation process as you get to know Him, as you get to love Him and realize that He loves you. He loves each one of us. We're like His sons and His daughters. And He wants to do things for us. The only thing that keeps Him from doing more for us is us. We get in the way. We don't let Him do for us what He would like to do. Just like any of you who are parents out there realize how much you want to do for your children. But sometimes you know it's not good for them. You know that they wouldn't be able to handle it. You know that they might get the big head. So the Lord is all wise. But if we learn how to develop the appropriate relationship with Him, He will really take us to the limits of what He thinks we can tolerate. Well, at any rate, you would think that having gotten this temper under control, that maybe everything would be all right. But unfortunately, I had another major setback. See, I was a straight-A student when I entered high school. But when I got to the 10th grade, I ran into something very, very bad. It's called peers. P-E-E-R-S. People who encourage errors, rudeness, and stupidity. And see, that's what negative peers are. And that's what they were doing. That's exactly what they were doing. They were saying things like, you got to wear certain types of clothing to be acceptable. Back in those days, the Italian knit shirts were the big things with the suede fronts. And there were other paraphernalia that went with them, but those were the big ticket items. And if you didn't have those, they made you feel like you should be at home under the bed, out of sight. And you had to be seen with certain people doing certain things. If you were a young black man in Detroit, if you didn't stay out late at night playing basketball, everybody questioned your hormonal integrity. So I started listening to all of this garbage, bit by bit. You know, I went from an A student, as I listened more, to a B student, as I listened more, to a C student. Kept listening, grades kept going down. And you know, the worst thing about it is, it didn't bother me. I didn't care that my grades were going down. Because all of a sudden, I was in with the in crowd. Guys were giving me high fives and slapping me on the back and saying I was cool. And I was one of the in crowd, and that's all that mattered. And I really didn't think about the fact that maybe I was throwing my career away. And that maybe I would never have an opportunity to recoup that. None of that seemed particularly important at that point. The only thing that seemed important was those Italian knit shirts. And you know the young people don't have Italian knit shirts nowadays. But, you know, every generation it's something different. Nowadays it's these big baggy pants look like you can fly in them. And they have these shoes, these gym shoes. I'm sure some of you have seen these gym shoes that cost $100, $150, sometimes $200. And they don't even do anything. There's no electronic equipment in them. They don't walk for you. And it's beyond me. The only thing I can see is some athlete gets on television and holds these things up and says, "These are wonderful. This is why I can shoot this basket." And the young people are silly enough to buy this stuff. And in some cases, to kill for this stuff. And it's absolutely ridiculous. It's what I call artificial value. The only reason it's worth anything is because somebody has gotten up and said, "This is valuable." But in and of itself, it has no value. Just like the Italian knit shirts, in and of themselves, had no value. Just like a lot of things that adults buy have no value. But they may have a nice name on them, like Gucci or something. So somebody feels that they have to go out and buy this garbage because somebody has put a name on it and proclaimed it valuable. You know, that's not being very wise if you sit down and you think about it. And of course, there's somebody sitting behind a big desk on Wall Street with their feet propped up on it with a big cigar, just laughing their heads off. Because people are silly enough to believe them when they say something is valuable, even though it has no inherent value. Now, that's the reason that God gave us 14 billion cells and connections up here, so that we could decipher for ourselves those things that are important and those things that are valuable, as opposed to those things that somebody else said was valuable. And if we connect our lives with those of the Savior and ask for wisdom, we won't get caught up in those kind of traps. Now, this is not to say that you shouldn't have nice things. There's a difference between having nice things and having things that other people perceive as very nice but are not worth what you paid for them. I don't think the Lord has any trouble with somebody who lives in a $1 million house, as long as it's worth $1 million and as long as they can afford it. There is no place in the Bible that I see the necessity for people to take an oath of poverty. Absolutely not true. And, you know, people always bring up this thing about, well, you know, the Bible says it's harder for a rich man to get into heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And you know how hard it is to thread a camel through the eye of a needle. But that's not what the Bible really says, is it? Think about it. What's the eye of the needle? Well, it simply refers to one of the entry gates to the ancient city of Jerusalem. And it was a relatively low gate, and it was called the Eye of the Needle. And when somebody came through on their camel, they would be too tall, so the camel would have to go down to its knees and then crawl through the eye of the gate. Actually pretty easy once you learn how to do it. And that's all it's saying. For a rich man to get to heaven, he needs to get on his knees too and recognize where it all came from. Doesn't say anything about you need to be poor. So young people, if people tell you that, tell them that they can be poor if they want to, but you don't necessarily see that as a prerequisite. Well, at any rate, I remember one day I was sitting there complaining to my mother about not having these Italian knit shirts and how I was being deprived of these things. And how I would not be able to go to school without them. And she was tired of hearing this by now. So she said, "Benjamin, I'll tell you what. I'm going to take all the money that I earned this week scrubbing people's floors and washing windows, etc. And I'm going to turn it over to you. I want you to take it, and you pay for the food, and you pay the bills. You take care of all the family's necessities. And with all the money that's left over, go out and buy all the Italian knit shirts you want. And I said, all right, now you're talking. So I sat down and started allocating money for the food and for the bills. You know, I ran out a long time before it came to close. And I realized that she must have been a financial genius to keep us alive at all, to keep a roof over our head, to keep clothes on our backs. Even if they did come from the Goodwill, she was very handy with needle and thread. And she knew how to stretch food, and she knew how to save money, and she was thrifty. But you know, I realized something more important than that. I realized how incredibly selfish I was being. I mean, here I was asking for a $75 Italian knit shirt when she was making maybe $100 a week working three jobs. And it dawned on me how incredibly stupid that was. I mean, what was the value of these shirts? Why were they any better than the shirt that could be gotten from the Goodwill as long as it was clean and it covered your back? And I made a choice in life that day. That choice was to start listening to the people who had my best interest in mind and stop listening to the peer group. And I decided I would go back to my studies, and in no time at all, I was a straight-A student again. Of course, the guys didn't like that very much. And, you know, they were on my case immediately, calling me nerd, Poindexter, all kinds of things. But, you know, at that point, I really didn't care what they had to say because I had perspective. And I had a vision in terms of where I was going. And I used to always be able to shut them up by saying one thing. I said, let's see where I'm going to be in 20 years. And let's see where you're going to be in 20 years. And then we'll see who made the right choices. You know, they must have believed me because when I graduated from high school, all those same people voted me most likely to succeed. So they clearly recognized that I was doing the right thing. They just didn't want to do it. They were too lazy. It's what I call the crabs in the barrel phenomenon. Now, good, steady Seventh-day Adventists have never seen crabs in a barrel. But if you put a bunch of crabs in a barrel, one tries to crawl out, the other ones grab them, and they pull them back down. They don't want them to get out of there. They don't want them to get out of there. And you know, that's what happens. A lot of times, young people, sometimes not so young people, they see somebody else in their environment achieving, doing the right thing, and they try to discourage them. They try to belittle those accomplishments. They try to make that person act like they're acting because they don't want to see that person get ahead of them. And yet they're unwilling to do the work necessary to get ahead themselves. It's a trap that a lot of young people fall into, wishing to be part of the crowd. And see, what you have to realize is that a relatively small part of your life is spent as a young person, as a teenager or an adolescent. Most of your life is spent as an adult. The vast majority of your life is spent as an adult. And yet, what you do and what you accomplish as an adult is largely shaped by what you do as a young person and the kinds of mindsets that you develop as a young person. So it has a profound effect. And you can't be too concerned about those 4 years or those 8 years in the academy or in the public school or wherever you are. You can't be too concerned about what those students think about you. Because you have to realize that if you allow them to drag you down, if you allow them to blunt your potential, you spend the rest of your adult life paying for it. And no one suffers more than you do from not having taken advantage of that opportunity when it was there in front of you. Well, at any rate, I remember once I got back on the right track, I had a very favorite television program, one of the few we could watch. It was called GE College Bowl. They would put different colleges against each other every Sunday evening, and they would ask questions, science and math and history, geography, all kinds of academic subjects. And I was pretty good, and I said, I want to be a contestant on College Bowl when I go to college. But there was one or two categories I wasn't very good in: art and classical music. So I said, I got to brush up on that stuff. So I started going downtown to the Detroit Institute of Arts, and I would study those paintings until I knew every painting by name, who had painted it, when they were born, when they died, what period or era it represented. And all the kids thought I was crazy. I mean, can you imagine a black kid in Motown listening to Mozart? But I didn't care what they thought, because I wanted to be a contestant on College Bowl. I had long-range goals here in mind. You know, I was like the Japanese. I was looking down the pike. I wasn't just looking at tomorrow. So anyway, I even decided which college I would attend based on that program. You see, I only had $10, which was the application fee to one college. So I said, I'm going to apply to the college that wins the grand championship in College Bowl this year. And, you know, they had the playoffs and everything, and it came down to the finals. And it turned out the finals that year were between Harvard and Yale. And Yale just thrashed Harvard. It was a horrible, humiliating defeat. So I certainly didn't want to associate myself with a bunch of dummies, so I didn't apply to Harvard. I applied to Yale. And fortunately, they accepted me with a scholarship. And off I went, thinking I was perhaps the smartest person in the world, and if not, certainly in the top five. But it wasn't long before I was disabused of that notion. You see, because there I was coming from Southwestern High School in inner city Detroit. But you know, I discovered something. I discovered I didn't have a lot of competition there. And there I was thrust into a situation with students who were absolutely tops from the top prep schools all over the country and all over the world. And all of a sudden, I started wondering what I was doing there at all. And it really came down to a difficult time at the end of that first semester. I was pre-med. And of course, as a pre-med, you have to do very well in all subjects, but particularly in the science courses. And yet, it was the night before the final in chemistry, and I was failing. I wasn't even close. Not even close, because I was one of those people who would wait, generally speaking, until an exam was almost up on you, and then cram. And usually I did okay on the exam, but 3 weeks later I didn't know a thing about that exam, something called a superficial learner. I'm sure no one out there knows anyone like that. But that kind of learning really is kind of a waste of your time and a waste of your money. It's not doing anything for you. But there I was, not even the slightest hope of passing. And I said, Lord, I always thought you wanted me to be a doctor. And yet, it looks like I'm going to fail freshman chemistry. And that's going to pretty much terminate my chances. And I said, therefore, would you indicate to me what it is you really want me to do? Or, alternatively, and preferably, would you work a miracle? Well, at that point I took out my chemistry textbook and started flipping through and memorizing formulas and until I fell asleep. And I dreamed I was in a large auditorium all by myself, and there was a nebulous figure working out chemistry problems on the blackboard. And I was taking notes diligently. And when I awakened early that next morning, that dream was so vivid in my mind, I could remember the problems. And I quickly jotted them down and started looking things up in my textbook. And then I went off to that exam, and I opened the first page of that final exam, and I could hear the music from the Twilight Zone. Because I recognized that first problem as one of the ones I had dreamed about. And then I looked at the next one, and I recognized it. And the next one, and I recognized it. Right through the exam. And I aced the exam, as one might imagine, under those circumstances. But you know, and I did well in the course, that made a big impression on me. Because I knew that God wanted me to do something in medicine. And I promised Him that day that He would never, ever have to do anything like that for me again. I promised Him that I was going to become an in-depth learner, that I was going to learn for the sake of knowledge and understanding, like Solomon talks about so often in the book of Proverbs. That I would be the kind of individual who would know my material so thoroughly that I could not be intimidated by other people. And once I made that decision, I found college a lot easier from that point on. But I realized that it was something serious. It wasn't just something you were there to have a good time. The Lord gave me some experiences there that really helped to improve my faith in Him. There was one time when I was flat broke, not a dime, not even bus fare, get to church. I said, Lord, I need some money. So I was walking on the old campus over by Battelle Chapel, and I looked down by the bike rack, and there was a $10 bill on the ground. And I said, praise the Lord. Well, about a year and a half later, same thing happened. Flat broke, not a dime. And I said, Lord, I need some money. So I went back over to Battelle Chapel by the bike rack, looked on the ground, no $10. And I said, Lord, what's the story here? I need some money. Well, that day we had had a final exam in one of my chemistry courses, psychology. And there was an article that had come out in the paper saying that all those exams had inadvertently been destroyed. And that everybody would have to show up to retake the exam that evening. So everybody showed up, and it was a big course, about 150 people. And the exam was a different exam, though, and it was very difficult. But each one of the questions had enough elements in it that looked familiar that you would think you should know the answer. But nobody knew any of the answers. So one by one, people started slipping out of the room. They were going to say they hadn't seen the notice, hopefully bone up on this material. And pretty soon, there was only 100 people left, and then 50, and then 25, and then 10. And I looked up. I was the only person in the room, at which time the door opened up, and in came the professor, along with a photographer and the newspaper editor, took my picture and presented me with a $10 bill. Being the most honest student in the class, it was all a hoax. But you know, the Lord has a lot of ways of answering your prayers. You know, sometimes it's not necessarily what you think, but somehow it all seems to work out. Well, at any rate, it was time to go on to medical school. And I remember people were always concerned back in those days about whether they were going to get into medical school or not. It was a tremendous crush. I remember in my class of 1,200, 700 were pre-med. And it was sort of the favorite topic of conversation, your anxieties about getting into medical school. And I remember one day we were sitting around the table and we were talking about it, and someone said, "Carson, how come you're not anxious about getting into medical school?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to the University of Michigan." And they said, "But how do you know?" And I said, "Well, my father owns it." Boy, you should have seen the looks. I mean, it was not unusual at Yale for people's fathers to own big corporations and things, but the University of Michigan, they were pretty impressed. But see, they didn't realize which father I was talking about. And see, that's the advantage of having that connection with God. Because you see, He owns the universe. He owns everything. And since we're His children, He wants to share it with us. So what do we have to worry about? Now, we spend an inordinate amount of time worrying about things. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, in fact, 2 weeks ago, exactly, to this day. In fact, I might have been this very hour. I was in the air in the Bahamas. I was flying from Freeport to Nassau. And it was in a private twin-engine plane. And we were about 10 miles out from Nassau, still over the water. And one of the engines went dead. And the plane started trying to flip. I mean, the nose started going up and the plane started dropping. And the pilot wasn't quite sure what to do. And he was grappling around and grasping and pulling on things. And he turned around and said, "We're in trouble." I kind of knew that already. But as we got closer to the airport, you could see the airport in the distance. They had cleared the runways, and they had the fire engines out waiting for us because they knew we were going to crash. And sweat was pouring off the pilot. There were three other people beside the pilot in the plane. And he couldn't get the nose gear to go down. So what he finally had to do is sort of dive for the runway with the hope that he'd be able to pull up at the last minute and land. And he was so concerned. But you know, I was just taking a joyride myself because I knew the Lord had the thing under control. And I knew it wasn't time for me to go yet. And, of course, I'm here today, so you know it worked out okay. But those kinds of situations really don't worry me a lot because my Father owns the universe. And I know He's in control. And I don't think it's necessary, really, when He's in control, to spend a lot of time worrying about things. You know, Jesus, when He was on earth, spend a little time chastising people about worrying. He says, "All you have to do is cast your cares upon Him, for He careth for you." And align yourself with the most powerful force in the universe, and things are going to work out. They may not work out the way you expect them to work out. Generally, they work out better than you expected them to. Well, at any rate, I did wind up going to the University of Michigan. And I thought I was going to be a psychiatrist at that time. You know, I decided I wanted to be a missionary doctor when I was 8 years old from listening to the mission stories in church. But when I was 13, having grown up in dire poverty, I decided I'd rather be rich. So at that point, I decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist. Now, I didn't know any psychiatrists, didn't know any doctors. But at least on television, psychiatrists, you know, they always seem to live in these big mansions and drove Jaguars and had these big plush offices. And all they had to do was sit around and talk to crazy people all day. Seemed like I did that most of the time anyway. So I said, may as well make a good living at it. And I majored in psychology in college and did advanced psych when I first went to medical school. But that's when I started meeting a bunch of psychiatrists. And some of my best friends are psychiatrists. And there's nothing wrong with psychiatrists, usually. But I did discover that my concept of psychiatry was wrong. You see, I had gleaned my concept of psychiatry from television, and it wasn't anything like that in reality. And young people, there's a message in that. You know, a lot of stuff that you see on television, not really very true to life.